For as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated with wolves. I can't pinpoint when my fascination started, but I continue to be inspired to learn all that I can about them and to educate myself and others about the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to the treatment of wolves in America today, right now, in current times. From childhood stories like Peter and the Wolf to groundbreaking documentaries like Jamie and Jim Dutcher's or Dutcher's Living with Wolves, the powerful book Wolf Nation by acclaimed author Brenda Peterson, the plight of wolves have been chronicled and people's mission to eliminate them continues to perplex me. Why do some people fear wolves? Why are they obsessed with bringing about their extinction? But that's not the point of this podcast. This podcast is about one man who has recorded more sightings of wild wolves than any other person on the planet. If Wolf Watchers was an official tribe, it's my opinion he would be the tribal chief. Stay with me to hear his powerful and engaging story. Hi, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth. And I could not possibly be more excited about our guest, and I don't say that lightly. His name is Rick McIntyre. Rick is many things, but he is a renowned wolf researcher. But above all else, he is a gifted storyteller, and I have had the gift of hearing some of his stories. In his most recent book, The Rise of Wolf 8, Rick clearly demonstrates his passion and dedication to wolves and to their survival. The book, part of a bold new trilogy, will transform your understanding of wolves forever, and I know that because it did mine. As Robert Redford writes in the foreword of the book, through McIntyre's eyes, we witness and learn about wolves as unique individuals living with breathtaking intensity, and it's impossible not to be awed by their loyalties to each other, their keen intelligence, and their will to survive. And I am so excited because I can attest to all of that, having read the book from cover to cover, having been blessed to have spent time with Rick in Yellowstone this summer, and reading some other books and talking to some other major human beings who have impacted my life, like Brenda Peterson. So, Rick, that was a kind of long and wordy introduction, but I had to get it down and I had to get it out.
Well, thank you, Gina, and to me, and I certainly enjoyed the time that you were with me in Yellowstone this summer. So thank you for having me on your show.
And you're more than welcome. My first question is, I live with part of my heart in Yellowstone and watch every special that I can and yada, yada. What is the weather like in Yellowstone? And did you go out today to observe the wolves?
Well, by our standards, relatively mild. It was in the 20s. It's been a mild winter. Snow has been a little bit less than normal. Unfortunately, this was a day where I didn't see anything. One of the woman wolf biologist was out before me. She hiked up a ridge and did see one female wolf. I joined her and we gave it a try, but unfortunately we didn't have anything when we were there. But yesterday I did get to see 10 wolves, and that was a pack ironically called the Phantom Pack, that it's very, very difficult for us to find them. They are phantoms. So that's been a goal for a while for me to see that group, and I did see them yesterday. So feel pretty good about that.
That's really pretty good. And, you know, I told you a little bit off air about my challenge and my frustration in prepping for the show and why I was having such angst. And I called Kelly a few times to say, you know, I'm having trouble nailing this. And what occurred to me is, I don't think you can put the Rick Mackin story, nor McIntyre story, or the your experience and the story of wolves into a one-hour podcast. You've had an incredible impact on humanity. Your book is amazing and filled with quite a bit of content. So we decided we might talk to David Attenborough about doing a series on wolves, because you would have to say be continued, but let's just do the best we can. And I would just briefly like to share my moment in Yellowstone, because that is the foundation for seeing through my lens of a person that is retired, that goes out every single day. You and other wolf watchers like Lori Lyman and many others, volunteers to observe the behavior of the wolves. And it's sometimes long hours, sometimes freezing cold weather, sometimes not a lot of action. And that kind of dedication is what I observed. I was freezing and it was not winter. And you stay out there and you're patient. And so are the other wolf watchers, as I call them so lovingly, with their scopes, inviting people that come up that are kind of little, like I was a little timid about sharing your scope because you're the wolf watcher after all. But you invite people in and you give them information. You tell them where the wolf is. We were fortunate enough that there was a kill. So I just wanted to try and give our listeners a sense of why my enthusiasm. And I want to talk about the rise of Wolf 8, witnessing the triumph of Yellowstone's underdog. But I think we have to start with a little bit of a foundation, which really starts with the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone in 95. So can you briefly share with us that short, it's like a longer story, but we have to, I think it's important to give listeners a sense of why they would so want to read this book. It's a great story.
Well, thank you, Gina. Yes, in Yellowstone, which of course is the world's first national park established in 1872, at that time, the wolf was very much a native animal like the bison, elk, and grizzlies. But the early rangers, like pretty much everyone else in the country during that era, hated wolves and felt that they needed to be exterminated. And they certainly mounted a very effective campaign to accomplish just that. They finished the job in 1926, just a few miles from where I am right now. A bison died. The local rangers encircled it with wolf traps. The next morning, there were two young wolves caught in the traps. They were shot and killed. And as far as I know, that was it. The last of the original Yellowstone wolves were killed in 1926. It took a long time for the agency that I spent my career in, the National Park Service, to realize what a mistake they had done back in the old days. But to our credit, it was finally realized that that never should have been done, to kill off a native animal in a national park. It was a long and difficult road to come up with a reintroduction plan for the wolves, to get it accepted politically, and then finally to plan it out and then implement it. But cutting to that moment, just a little bit over 25 years ago, on January 12th of 1995, wolves were brought in from British Columbia, a total of 14. Three packs altogether, and that was the start of the reintroduction program. The following year, another 17 wolves were brought in from another part of Canada. Actually, the first time it was from Alberta, the second time from British Columbia. So it started with 31. We feel that the original population of Yellowstone was about 100 wolves. Being large carnivores, wolves live at a low density. Yellowstone is 2 million acres. That's about 3,500 square miles. So we feel that the original density of wolves in that area of Yellowstone was only about 100. And that's what the population eventually settled out at with the reintroduced population. That's about what it is right now, 100.
So was the impetus behind it getting wolves back in the park? Or was there really, was the genesis of it, what type of ecological impact it could have? Because there was definitely degradation of environment. There were overpopulation of elk. What was the motivation or the genesis for bringing them back in the first place? Because there was quite a bit of controversy about it. So why? Why did they want to do this?
Well, there's two ways that we can, it was actually larger than just Yellowstone. It was for the whole Northern Rockies. So simultaneous with the Yellowstone reintroduction, another one was done in the central part of Idaho. But since my experience is within Yellowstone, why don't we concentrate on that?
Yes.
I think the simplest way that we can talk about it is to say that Yellowstone really should be one of the few places in the world where people can come and they can see the original native array of wildlife, along with the geysers, the forests, the rivers, the waterfalls, everything else, to come here and see what it originally was like. And so it just was not the real Yellowstone without the wolves in it. It was like there was an unnatural silence here because no one could hear the sound of a wolf howling. Thoreau had a very dramatic explanation in one of his journals about how he grew up in a time in Massachusetts where he could not hear wolves howling. He felt it was like listening to a symphony with one part missing. So the wolves were a native animal. It was a mistake to kill them off. And this is one of the few times where a federal agency realized that it had made a major mistake and figured out how to make up for that mistake. So that's the way that I see it.
So it's just my mind is reeling because, yes, there were introduction of wolves in other parts, but it's not what you read about. It's not what they do specials on. Is it because this was kind of like under the looking glass with so many visitors? Because the part of the story about the ecological impact is one that can be applied in other places. So it was, yes, there were other places that it happened, but this was under the looking glass or through the looking glass and under the microscope, or I'm not sure what words I'm searching for, but it was more widely publicized. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, yes. A lot of it on the success of this project. If it failed, probably many, many other similar projects that could have taken place would have been canceled. So the stakes were very, very high. And there are a lot of moments just before the reintroduction and then after it where there were crises and certain people had to make decisions immediately. They were very, very difficult to make because no one had ever dealt with this before. I'll give you an example. One of the alpha males, wolf number 10, shortly after when the wolves arrived, they were kept in acclimation pens for a couple of months to get used to the park, to settle in so they would think of it as their new home. Anyway, after his family was released, on the very day that his mate gave birth to 8 pups, the first pups born in Yellowstone in 69 years, the father wolf was illegally shot and killed. So it was a crisis for the Park Service. And the people that were involved in dealing with that decided that this was such an important wolf family, that mother wolf and her 8 pups, that they were going to mount a rescue. Normally, the Park Service would not do that with wild animals. But because the dilemma was created by a bad guy committing a horrendous illegal act, that justified it. So they caught the mother wolf. They got the 8 pups out of the den. And they put them back in the acclimation pen where those pups had been conceived. And for the 6 months that they were there, as the pups grew, they were fed a couple of times a week with carcasses of animals that had been killed on the road, mainly elk and sometimes bison. But then the critical thing that was coming up at the six-month point, when that family was released, how was the mother going to be able to cope with that situation? Just one mother, single mother with 8 young pups. And the main character of my book, Wolf Ape, that's where he comes on the scene. So Wolf Ape came down as a pup with his family. He was part of the Crystal Creek Pack. The other pack was known as the Rose Creek Pack. And Ape was the smallest pup in his litter. He was the runt. And rangers that dealt with his pen and his family told me that he was picked on and bullied and beaten up while they were in the pen. But after they're released, he began to come into his own. And about the time that they're going to be releasing the other family, he was at a point in his life where he was starting to look for a mate. He was about 1.5 years old. And we think that he just was walking up this one creek one day. He had heard howling up there. We think that he wanted to see what was going on. And probably when he came around a corner in the creek, he saw something that he'd never seen before in his life, and that was wolves that were smaller than him. Some of the pups from that pen had already been released. 8 had always been the smallest wolf in his world. He had never seen one smaller than he was, so this was just a revelation to him. But probably the most important moment in the history of the reintroduction here was what happened next. He ran forward and befriended those pups. And that very moment was the beginning of him adopting them and then raising them over the next few years. So the mother wolf saw the kind way that he had treated her pups. She was desperate for help. Just looking at him, he was not the most ideal candidate to be her mate and father of those 8 pups and the alpha male, but he was there. And it looked like he was volunteering for that duty. And he became a great, great alpha male. So that's how the book starts, with the story of 8 adopting those pups and raising them.
And then it's like, you know, you had me from hello, because some of your humor cracked me up in the book. And let's just dive into the book a little bit. But the thing that continues to obsess me, and I'm obsessed with this whole conversation of, in my opinion, to know wolves is to love them. And I don't say that as some pithy statement. They're ferocious. They are competitive. You want to make sure you're in the strongest pack. It's survival of the fittest. It's not easy out there. And yet, it's almost like they're, I don't know, multi-personality disorder, because they care about their pups. They care about other pups that are part of their pack. They, you know, one of the things I think you wrote in this book, that like they invented the first home delivery system for food. And I was like cracking up. I know I underlined it, because they deliver. And I'm like, what? This is Rick. It was like, yeah, oh, okay. Just call, home delivery, and the wolves have got you covered. But it's true. They take care, and they go ahead. They do.
Yeah, they invented it before Amazon. Amazon needs to pay them some kind of a copyright infringement based on that.
Jeff Bezos will get right on that, I'm sure.
What you're talking about for your listeners is when 8 was helping to raise those pups, when he would go out on a hunt and then make a kill, usually it would be an elk. An adult male wolf can probably gulp down about 20 pounds of meat, and then will rush home. And then when the pups see, in this case, they considered him their father. When they see their father come in, then they run over and do exactly the same thing that a pet dog does to its human friends. The pups will jump up and try to lick the adult's face. And that triggers a regurgitation. So he opens his mouth really wide and starts bringing up all that meat. Now, I'm not sure exactly how the wolves do this, but they don't really digest it as they're bringing it back. So it looks like big pieces of stew meat. So that all comes up, and the pups gulp it down as quick as they can. So everyone that has had the experience of having a dog friend licking their face, that is the origin of that behavior. That goes back to their wolf ancestors, and that's how they would get an adult to feed them.
And I don't know where in the book, like, I really was hooked, and I don't think I'm ordinary. I don't. I have an overly curious or intense sense of all of this. But I know one particular chapter that I wanted to talk to you about was den troubles for the Rose Creek wolves. And it talks about Wolf 8. But the thing that got me about that chapter is that we have a dog. And if I'm upset or crying, or I had a migraine the other day, a really bad migraine, and that dog knew it, I don't care. That dog knew it, stayed by my side, laid on top of me because she knows how much I love it. With each one of us, that dog knows. And in this chapter, it's like, yeah, that's wolf behavior. Like, they do big brother, little brother things. And I don't think that's top of mind for most people when they think about wolves. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think what, Gina, is that incident where one of the pups that ate Ray's grew up to be our most famous wolf, number 21.
Right.
The second book in the series is about him. And so when 21, I guess he was about 2 years old, that would be kind of like maybe a teenager in human years, maybe 18 years old, something like that. He and his adopted father, eight by that time, they had kind of become best friends. They were a duo. They would go out hunting. I spoke at Sundance last fall, and when I did a talk there, I thought of the analogy that except for the robbing banks part, it was kind of like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 21 and 8. And so 8 was the mentor of 21, and 21 saw 8 as his role model. And so in the spring of 1997, when 21 was just about 2 years old, he was just this powerhouse in going out with 8. They would team up and make kills, bring back food, feed the mother wolf and the pup. One day when 21 came back, he was very tired. I'm sure he was exhausted. I think he just really wanted to sleep after he had fed the pups that had run to him. But we knew that there was a sickly pup. We never quite figured out what was wrong with that guy, but he would kind of stay away from the others, and he didn't really seem to move around too well. We didn't know if he had problems with his vision or his physical development. He would walk around and fall over a lot. And oftentimes when 21 would bring in food, he would be too far away and seem to miss out. But 21 would pay attention to that, and after greeting his mother, sharing food with her and feeding the other pups, he would notice that missing one, and he would deliberately get up, walk over to where that guy was, and kind of like your story with your dog, just bed down right beside it. Big brother bedded down with little brother. And it was really a very touching thing to see. And he did that consistently. And I think your story is a perfect example of how that relates to dog behavior and how they try to do what they can to comfort their human friend. They really understand those things, and they do what they can to be helpful. I'll especially emphasize the fact that he really deserved to rest, but he did not do that until he took care of that pup. Now, I do a lot of talks for young kids, and that's one of their favorite stories when I tell them that. And to make the point a little bit stronger, I often ask them if they've ever had a bad day at school where they were bullied, they were yelled at, they got a bad mark on a test or something, and they come home really feeling bad about themselves, and their dog sees them. And their dog understands that they're not feeling too good. And their dog wants to be with them. Their dog wants to be their friend. And that's a pretty good thing to have in life. And the irony of that is that exact behavior of dogs, which we love so much, is one more thing that comes directly from their wolf ancestors, directly from a wolf just like 21.
And kind of what I want to do for our listeners is just ask all of you to like press pause. And you just described this whole scenario, and it all came from people watching and recording and documenting the behavior of the wolves. Because if you weren't doing that, we wouldn't know any of this. We wouldn't know a fraction of this. And that's part of my obsession. I don't have the patience or the tenacity, even though I have passion. After about the fifth day out there, I'd probably be going stark raving mad. And you're out there every day being patient, educating people, explaining where the wolves are. I mean, I remember when one started howling and I came over to you, I said, Rick, isn't that a wolf howling? And you, with a very gentle and kindly manner, said, everyone, please be quiet. There were a lot of tourists on the hill, myself being one of them. We have a wolf howling. And it got quiet immediately. It's like coming over me right now because I'm back there with that sense of place. And that translated to a magic moment for me to hear a wolf howling in the wild. And I don't know if I can, this is what was bugging me about how to get some of these questions out. I don't think that most people are as obsessed with wolves, like the wolf watchers and all of the people that you attract. People come to Yellowstone to see the wolves, to meet you, to meet Lori, to talk to other wolf watchers, because there's a, what is there, Rick? A mystery, a fear, a, what is the intrigue of wolves? Because I have it and I don't know why.
Well, there's a lot to say about that. One thought is it's oftentimes said that there are no two species on Earth that are so similar in social behavior as wolves and humans. And the proof of that is how well a dog, the modern version of the wolf, fits into a human family. So nearly everyone at some point in their life has had a pet dog, and so they've had a relationship with a dog. They spent a lot of time with it. They played with their dog. They understood dog. They had a sense that their dog understood them. So wolves in the wild live in a pack that is very much like an extended human family, a large human family. Most people are familiar with the terms alpha male and alpha female. In most packs, that just simply means the father wolf and the mother wolf. The way that a pack starts is that a young male meets a young female, they pair off, and that's the start of a pack. They begin to have pups. And when those pups are about a year old, when they're yearlings, then they're at the point where they can help take care of the next litter of pups, just like 21 did when he was a yearling. And so it goes on year after year, generation of generation. The young wolves learn from the older wolves, and then when they're grown up themselves, they help the older wolves raise the new ones. Now, getting back to 8 and 21, when 21 was about 2.5 years old, he had actually stayed with his mother and adopted father for longer than average. He had a longer apprenticeship than most young males. But then it was time for him to leave home. And we knew that the neighboring pack, the Druid Peak Pack, was a very aggressive, very violent pack. They had killed some wolves previously. And 21, by himself, as a lone wolf, just very confidently strolled into the middle of that pack's territory. We thought that was a very, very dangerous thing for him to do. Now, by that time, he was a big, strong male. And we were eventually to see that he would be the undisputed, undefeated heavyweight champion of Yellowstone, but we didn't quite know that at that time. Anyway, 21 always had a knack of being in the right place at the right time. And when he arrived, the alpha male of the Druid Pack had been illegally shot and killed outside the park. So he showed up at exactly the right moment. There were several adult females in that pack with young pups. They were desperate for a new guy to come in as their alpha. And here's 21 coming on the scene. So that was the next stage in his life when he ended his apprenticeship and his mentoring by 8 and took everything he learned from his adopted father and then set out into the world and joined the neighboring pack.
But Wolf 8 is an anomaly in some ways, if you ask me. First of all, Wolf 8 was small than the others. In the beginning of the book, you described that he was often bullied, but he really went up the food chain, so to speak, the chain of command. So give us a little insight. I want everybody who listens to this to read the book, obviously, because they'll get as excited as I do, because you know, you're talking about 12 and 21 and 8, and all of a sudden they have faces and personalities. And I admit I had to look back sometimes and say, okay, which one was that? But you can do it because you weave a story around it. So tell us a little bit more about Wolf 8.
Well, certainly a like underdog. He was small when he was born, and we talked about how he was bullied and pushed around. All of his brothers were quite a bit bigger than he was. The moment where I began to see that there was more to him than we quite realized. It was a very dramatic incident. This is before he met 21. He was out with some of his brothers. They were the same age, but they were quite a bit bigger and stronger than he was. And they were away from their parents. And they really weren't doing anything too significant. But suddenly, they perked up. They ran into a small forest. And in those trees, I could see animals running back and forth. And I couldn't quite figure out what they were doing. Were they just playing tag or something like that? But then one of the brothers ran out, and in his jaws was a freshly killed elk calf. So now I was pretty impressed with what these brothers had done. The second of the three brothers ran out, and then last in line, as always, because he was the slowest and the clumsiest, was eight. So the three brothers had worked together, seemingly, to get that elk. I was impressed. But it turned out that that wasn't the real story, because right behind eight running out of the forest was a huge grizzly. And the truth was that the grizzly had killed the elk, and the three brothers had worked together to steal it from him. Now, I guess that was a pretty good accomplishment for them, but the big problem was that the grizzly was gaining on the wolves. And since eight was last in line, the bear was getting closer and closer to him. So it looked like in a few moments the bear would reach eight, smack him to the ground, kill him, and then go after his brothers and retrieve the elk. It then was totally unexpected, especially in light of his history. He stopped running, he turned around, and he confronted this huge grizzly bear. He stood up to him. The grizzly bear was so surprised by that, he didn't expect that at all. He stopped running, and he looked at this little wolf. He looked past the wolf. He couldn't see the brother that had the calf right now. The bear was confused, and he didn't really know what to do, and he just kind of gave up on the whole thing and turned around and went back the way he came. But neither one of eight brothers saw what he had done that day. I was the only one that witnessed it. So they ran off, and they ate the elk, and they didn't share it with eight. So he was a hero, but no one knew he was a hero.
Except
and his
you.
Family, just me. Yeah.
And they can't read. They
so
couldn't read your story.
Yeah. Maybe someone could read it to that. Anyway, so that was the turning point in my understanding that, hey, this guy had something going for him. You know, it would be like a parent or, you know, any adult, you know, knowing that a kid was a little bit undersized and then starting to see, well, you know, there's really more to this guy or this girl than anyone had been giving them credit for. They were going to amount to something. And probably one of the most dramatic moments in the early years of eight was about a year after he had adopted all those pups. And he was in the Slough Creek area. That was part of his territory. He had helped the yearlings, including 21, make a kill. It was an elk. They had fed on that. They were getting ready to bring back food to number eight, the mother wolf. By that time, eight was a biological father himself. He had fathered eight pups. So he still had those eight, they were yearlings now that he had adopted, and now three newborn pups of his own. And he stopped what he was doing, began to stare off on a ridge to the west. I thought he saw some more elk that maybe he could hunt. And I looked in that direction with my scope and saw that what he was looking at was not elk at all, but it was a rival pack of wolves that was charging down directly at him and his family. And in the lead of that pack was alpha male 38. He was the alpha male of the Druid pack. And I have to tell you a little bit about 38, about his background. He was one of the 17 wolves brought in a batch of packs of the reintroduction he and the other wolves were caught in British Columbia. Now, I happened to be in the park when the Druids arrived. They were brought down in individual metal cages on the inside of a horse trailer. The truck pulled into a lot where I was, and as the men got out just to kind of check everything before unloading the cages, they spoke with us a little bit, and they had a story to tell. When they were coming down on the interstate, they went to a rest area for a break, and as they always did, they looked through the slats in the trailer to see if everything was okay. And when they looked inside, one of the metal cages had been ripped open. And then calmly walking around in the inside of the horse trail like he owned the operation was Wolf 38. And these guys jumped back because that was a very startling sight to see. It was like in the movie King Kong where he tears off his chains and then goes on a rampage. But they were able to tranquilize 38 and they put him in a stronger cage, a bigger cage. So 38, that was the very wolf that was running down at wolf number 8, intending to attack him and his family. And there was even more in the background to that. Several months prior to that, 38 and the Druid wolves had attacked 8's original family, the Crystal Creek Pack, and killed 8's father. So this wolf that was about to attack 8's family was the very wolf that had killed his father. It's like something out of an action movie. Now, 8 was still undersized for an alpha male. I was with a bunch of people, and I felt I needed to prepare them for what was about to happen. I turned to the folks with me. There were maybe 15 or so, and I felt I had to be honest with them, and I said, when two male wolves fight, and there's a very significant difference in size and fighting ability, the fight is going to be over in just a couple of seconds. With a smaller, less able wolf being defeated on his back and in the helpless position, the winning wolf standing over that guy, and the way that one wolf kills another is to bite the throat. It's pretty much instant death.
Right.
So I had to prepare people for what they're about to see. And both of those wolves were gray. So as 8 was running uphill at 38, who was running downhill, that was just one more factor that put him at a huge disadvantage. He was smaller, not much of a fighter, and he had to run uphill to even start the fight. So they smashed into each other. They were rolling around on the ground. And then just as I had told the people with me, it was over. Maybe 2, maybe 3 seconds, something like that. And it took a moment for us to kind of realize what we were seeing because our brains just weren't functioning quick enough to understand it.
Right.
Because the winner was the little guy. 8 somehow, against all odds, all expectations, had defeated this monster-sized alpha male, the very wolf that had killed his father. It was just an unbelievable thing to see. If it was in a movie, you wouldn't believe it. It would be too much. So all the other younger wolves ran up, including 21. That must have very much impressed them. 8 bit 38 a few more times. And then when he did, a moment later, was just as amazing as him winning the battle. He stepped back and spared his life. 38 tucked his tail. He ran off. 8 chased him just to make sure that he was leaving the territory. And that's what happened that day. The little guy beat the big guy, had him at his mercy, could have killed him, but he spared his life. Now, in the coming years, that particular incident, I was able to show, had a huge influence on 21 because 21 grew up into this very, very large, very, very strong alpha male. As far as we know, he never came close to losing a fight. He was the undefeated, undisputed heavyweight champion. And he always followed the role modeling that he learned that day, the example that his adopted father set. He never lost a fight with another male wolf. And every time he won a fight, which was every battle, he always let the other guy go, always spared his life.
I mean, it's you know, you're the storyteller, and I'm sitting here, and I read a lot about that. I loved the chapter, you know, there's when Harry met Sally, and then there's when 21 met 42. And I just have to say to people, I asked you some of these amateur questions, but like, well, why don't you give them names and blah, 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 blah. Well, I understand. So 8 becomes a name to me, like a real living, breathing creature that I want to read more about and put questions about, and understanding that there's just, I know this sounds really weird, but they are a lot like humans. They really are. They don't really, you know, we don't go out and fight and bite each other's necks. But a lot of the other behaviors are so much like us, and so nurturing and caring and territorial. I mean, you know, there are wars, there are territories, there are, you know, I was thinking about Harry Potter and Gryffindor and all that stuff, and which would I want to be a druid? I don't think so. And all of these are the things that go on in my head, Rick. So that's pretty scary. It's like, what would I want to be? I think I'd want to be part of the Rose Creek. But anyway, I digress, and I was afraid that I might do that because it's like I stand there. So let's go back to not just Wolf 8, but it was intriguing to me. Not everybody is a wolf watcher. Not everybody cares. Not everybody's aware of the plight of the wolves, of the war against the wolves. Who did you write the book for? You know, I have this thing when I write, begin with the end in mind. Did you just write it to tell the story, or were you hoping that it would maybe change some people's minds, give people more of an insight into the majesty and magic and mystery of the wolves? Who did you write this book for? Because it wasn't just an easy book to write. It's a lot of content that had to be tracked, and you had to keep a lot of information to keep us interested. That's what I would say, to keep us interested as the story reader with you as the storyteller. So was there a really good question in there? Who did you write it for?
Well, I feel that I was given a gift of, you know, somehow ending up here in Yellowstone.
You think?
And somehow getting to see the wolves a lot, most every day. But most importantly, getting to know these charismatic, heroic wolf characters so intimately. And I felt that it was very much my duty and my responsibility to share those stories with everyone. I don't think that I was given the gift of being here and seeing all that just for my own education, my own enjoyment. I think the purpose of me seeing that was so that I could tell the stories to everyone. Now, as you know, I do a lot of talks for people here, school groups, visitors, etc. But it's a big world out there, and these are very important stories. And so I wanted a chance for everyone to be able to hear them. I felt I owe that to the wolves. I feel that every time I tell a story about a wolf, that's one more person that's going to be on the side of the wolf, that's going to have a better understanding of them. They live difficult lives, challenging lives, but also heroic lives. They're very oriented to their family, to their mates, to their pups, as we've discussed. They risk their lives for their families. And those are stories that are very easy for humans to relate to. We live in families, and sometimes we're in dangerous situations. We try to do the right thing for our family, our friends, our group. Sometimes for our country in terms of fighting in a warfare situation. So we did the same things. Now, we've talked about wolves that led very heroic lives like 8 and 21, but I also found that there were some wolves that were not in that category.
Right.
They did not have that heroic nature. And so they're not all the same. And so I feel that one more way that wolves and people are so much alike is that all of us have to make choices. So, for example, when a chose to charge and be willing to fight that much larger alpha male, a guy that he really had no business thinking he could defeat, he was very much willing to risk his life. In later years, I was to come to know alpha males or adult males that were certainly bigger and stronger than eight were, and under very similar circumstances would run away and kind of abandon their family and let them fend for themselves. So like people, wolves have different characters. They make different choices. And that's a whole other fascinating aspect of it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I'm laughing, but you can tell that I really love the book. And you met me, so you know how enthusiastic I am. But I kept thinking about what other species could you write this about, especially in Yellowstone? Certainly not the bison. They're boring. And I'm sorry to say that. I love watching them. There's not the intrigue. I don't want to be mean to the bison. I'm sorry. I hope that they don't hear about my attitude and come for my car someday. And they're beautiful. They're magnificent. They're humongous. But, you know, there's not much going on there from what I observed. And then the elk, who I think are majestic and wonderful. I'm sorry if I'm making you laugh, but I'm sitting there thinking, I mean, there's not a lot of species that have the complexity, the intrigue, the mystery, the competition, the forming packs. It's a story that just is enthralling. And I know I'm not alone. And you did it. You're talking about in this book, I'm sure I read it in this book. It's not mush. Didn't you compare, I hope I'm not really making a fool of myself on the air, but didn't you compare when you saw Wolf 8's brain, because Wolf 8 got kicked by calves, to the movie or the concussion where he repeated blows to the head, you know, creates a syndrome? I didn't make that up, right? I just read the book recently. Isn't there a part of that where that's how deep it goes?
Yes, you're referring to an aspect of the life of wolves that oftentimes people don't really think about. It's usually not in the documentaries or articles or things like that. But their day-to-day lives are very dangerous because the way that they earn their living is by hunting and then having battles to the death with prey animals that are way bigger than they are. So here in Yellowstone, their most common prey would be elk. An average wolf is about 100 pounds. Adult male and females, with males being a bit bigger than that and females a little bit smaller. And a big cow elk is 300 pounds. A bull elk is 700 pounds. So over the course of 8's life, he was in many, many battles with elk. I personally saw him get kicked in the head, stomped on, held underwater in battles with elk. Like a NFL player,
yeah,
or a professional boxer, he probably endured a lot of hits to the head, probably a lot of concussions. And so you might be referring to where I compared him to Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
Or the NFL players that have that,
yes,
I think it's called CTE, damage to their brain.
Yep.
And then in the book, I also describe that after he died, his skull was examined, and he had all sorts of horrendous injuries to his jaws. Many of his teeth had been broken off at the base due to a kick by an elk. One of his long canine teeth was broken off. One of his molars was missing. A friend of mine, Jim Halfpenny, who is an expert at examining skulls and carcasses, he measured the exact distance from the broken front tooth to the broken back tooth, and it was exactly the width of an elk hoof. So it pretty much proved that in one of his many, many fights with an elk to feed his family, he wasn't quick enough to get out of the way of a kick. He probably was kicked with a huge amount of force, maybe by a 700-pound animal, right in the side of his jaw, and had that damage. And that was just one day in his life. He had to do that repeatedly. And 21 was perhaps a little bit faster, maybe a little bit more agile than his adopted father. He certainly had to deal with very similar things. I was just writing about a wolf that was trampled by an elk and just got up and walked off. I've seen wolves that have been flipped up in the air by a bison. They can be 2,000 pounds. This one particular wolf, he was trying to impress a female that he was interested in, so he was kind of showing off a little bit too much. This cow elk hooked him under the belly with her horn, tossed him in the air, kind of like a trampoline type thing, and that was bad enough. I was expecting, well, he was going to crash on the ground, but he landed on top of the bison's head, and she tossed him in the air again, and then he crashed. And it was the mating season, and his prospective girlfriend kind of took one look at that, and it was kind of like she shook her head and just kind of walked away.
Oh my God. So everybody, these are the kind of things
that the right guy for him.
Yeah, that Rick McIntyre gets to observe, and you have to put a lot of time in to get to see those moments. But the day that we got there, the first person that greeted me when I was asking for you said, "Oh, you're so lucky. There was a kill last night, so that's a good thing for us." And it cracked me up because here is this humongous grizzly bear sitting on top of the elk, like sitting up on top of the elk. And we watched a lot of that for 2 days. And I remember asking you, you know, clearly in Yellowstone, the grizzly is the king of the jungle. And if you ever see a big one, you know exactly why. However, that grizzly was staying on that kill. And the wolves were kind of, I would say, not playing with it, but just like trying to get in close. And the grizzly bear was clearly not worried about the wolves, and they didn't get in. But is there at times a kind of, like, it is an acceptable, we know you're the boss, we're going to wait you out, and we're going to get what scraps there are. It's not all fighting. I saw a lot of play that day, a lot of patience on the part of the wolves. Is that normal, or was that like just lucky that I got to be there?
Well, you were lucky to see that, not to have been able to witness something as good as that. So you deserved it, I think.
I was so happy.
I think what you're talking about, you lived a good life. That was your reward.
Really? So far.
We do see that frequently. And what is repeated a lot if you're a wolf is that you take on the risk and the potential of being damaged, severely injured, or killed by having a fight to the death with a 300 to 700-pound animal. Let's say you do make the kill. Then you bring your family over to feed. But if it's anywhere between the spring and late fall, it's pretty likely that the local grizzly is going to get the scent of that blood on the air. And they're going to run in. Our grizzlies can be 400, 500, 600, 700 pounds. And yes, they can take over a carcass. Now, wolves have to deal with that all the time. It's like maybe if you own a retail store, to an extent, you kind of have to deal with shoplifters. That's just part of the deal. So wolves have to deal with grizzlies. But wolves can be patient, and these are large carcasses, so they can wait for the bear to leave and then run in. But if you have an alpha male like 21, he can be a very decisive factor. And 21 just had this level of both agility and courage and devotion to his family that was just so impressive. So this almost sounds like a joke, but this is exactly what he would do. He would sneak up behind the bear, bite the grizzly on the rear end because he wanted the bear to chase him. So the grizzly would turn around, was as mad as it could be, would chase the father wolf. And of course, as that was happening, 21's family would run in. They would snarf down as much meat as they could. And then when the bear realized that he'd been tricked by 21, would start running back. He would get to the carcass. He would start eating. And then all of a sudden, he'd get bitten on the rear end once more. And he turned around, and there was 21. So 21 was just smarter than the average grizzly bear, and he could keep on doing that. And the grizzlies would keep on chasing him and would never catch 21. So if you come back, Gina, as a wolf, keep that in mind. That's what you're going to need to do. Fight bears in the rear end.
I'm just going to come back to see you. And I found out a friend of ours owns a house in Livingston on the Yellowstone River. And she already knows, like, I'm so there. But can I just... We have to end. I want to read something so that people can really get a sense for this book and what they can expect in the next one, okay? It's towards the end, December in Yellowstone, and I circled it and asterisked it. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it was describing the Druids in Lamar Valley, and they were playing. That's how I'll set it up, okay? They were playing a pretending game. It says, then 21 jumped up and romped off, still in a playful mood. His tail was tucked down over his rear, making believe like the son had defeated the father in a wrestling match. He wagged his tail and romped alongside her like a pup greeting its mother. The next moment, he fell over on his side, the way a comedian might do for a pratfall for laughs. There was only one word to describe the antics of this father wolf as he played with his family on that Christmas day. Goofy. Now I have to read the next part. I have now watched and studied wolves for 40 years in Alaska, Montana, and Wyoming, and I have never seen another alpha male behave like that. But when 21 stood up, anyone could see him as he really was, the toughest, most powerful wolf in the park. If a Marvel Comics artist were to draw an idealized superhero wolf, a new member of the Avengers, the portrait would look like 21 did at that moment. Now, if that doesn't make listeners want to read the book, I feel sorry for them. That's all I'm going to say. It's like there are many moments in that where I'm like, you got to be kidding me. It's like when I first started understanding Shakespeare and realized how funny he was. So we are at an hour, and I'm sorry. That's all I can say. It's like we want to do a David Attenborough, more time with Rick McIntyre, and certainly we'll have the opportunity when your next book comes out. And I'm going to do my darndest to get you here for the Festival of Books in 2021 so that people can just have the honor of your presence and enjoy your sense of humor and all that stuff. So is there anything that I miss? Because I want to tell people, please don't get the book on Amazon unless they have to. I went to my local bookstore and they ordered it for me. And I'm a champion of local bookstores. So if you have to get on Amazon because you're in the middle of nowhere, please do. The Rise of Wolf 8 by Rick McIntyre. But think about your local bookstore and then buy a copy or two for people that you really love, that you want to share the joy with. So that's my commercial for you, Rick. That's how much I liked the book.
Well, that's very kind of you, Gina, and I appreciate you saying that. I can mention that the next book, which is called The Reign of Wolf 21 in the Valley of the Druid King, that will be out in late September.
Wow.
So the Wolf 8 book ends at about roughly the halfway point in 21's life. And so the second book continues his life story. And that's especially on the relationship that he had with his longtime mate, 42. So that's coming up next in just this fall, just a few months from now.
And you know we'll have you back. If you say yes, we'll say yes. And I'm in the pack, the Rick McIntyre pack. And I just would like to thank you. I have a few final words that I want to say to people. And that is, if at all possible, put Yellowstone high on your list of places to go. Go to the Lamar Valley. Look for Rick and the other wolf watchers, as I call them. I was going to call them wolf whispers, but you're really wolf watchers. Learn from them, watch them, and their generous, patient way of teaching us about the wolves. And you might even catch the favor like I did. And if it's not an option, which it isn't for many people around the country, and I honor that and understand it, get a copy of the book. Ask your library to get a copy of the book so that you can have like your inside edition look at this very sometimes misunderstood, albeit mighty and beautiful and majestic species. You will enjoy it and you'll probably call me and thank me. So if you can't tell how deeply I care about the stories and survival of these complex and magnificent creatures, feel free to give me a call. My number's on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. And thank you, all my wonderful listeners, because without you, where would we be? And thank you, Rick McIntyre, for all you do, for all the Wolf Watchers do, and for showing up in my life because you left a forever footprint. And that's my final word. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeannie, to me, and very happy to be on your show. You do a great job, and thank you very much for all you do.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, my friend, and I hope I see you this summer.